Chapter 2. Belgarath the Sorcerer was a man with many flaws in his character. He had never been fond of physical labor, and he was perhaps a bit too fond of dark brown ale. He was occasionally careless about the truth, and had a certain grand indifference to some of the finer points of property ownership. The company of ladies of questionable reputation did not particularly offend his sensibilities, and his choice of language very frequently left much to be desired. Polgora, the sorceress, was a woman of almost inhuman determination, and she had spent several thousand years trying to reform her vagrant father, but without much noticeable success. She persevered, however, in the face of overwhelming odds. Down through the centuries she had fought a valiant rearguard action against his bad habits. She had regretfully surrendered on the points of indolence and shabbiness. She grudgingly gave ground on swearing and lying. She remained adamant, however, even despite repeated defeats, on the points of drunkenness, thievery, and winching. She felt, for some peculiar reason, that it was her duty to fight on those issues to the very death. Since Belgarath put off his return to his tower in the Vale of Aldur until the following spring, Erend was able to witness at close hand those endless and unbelievably involuted skirmishes between father and daughter with which they filled the periodic quiet spaces in their lives. Polgora's comments about the lazy old man's lounging about in her kitchen, soaking up the heat from her fireplace and the well-chilled ale from her stores with almost equal facility, were pointed. And Belgarath's smooth evasions revealed centuries of highly polished skill. Erend, however, saw past those waspish remarks and blandly flippant replies. The bonds between Belgarath and his daughter were so profound that they went far beyond what others might conceivably understand. And so, over the endless years, they found it necessary to conceal their boundless love for each other behind this endless facade of contention. This is not to say that Polgora might not have preferred a more upstanding father, but she was not quite as disappointed in him as her observations sometimes indicated. They both knew why Belgarath set out the winter in Poledra's cottage with his daughter and her husband. Though not one word of the matter had ever passed between them, they knew that the memories the old man had of this house needed to be changed. Not erased, certainly, for no power on earth could erase Belgarath's memories of his wife. But rather they needed to be altered slightly, so that this thatched cottage might also remind the old man of happy hours spent here, as well as that bleak and terrible day when he had returned to find that his beloved Poledra had died. After the snow had been cut away by a week of warm spring rains and the sky had turned blue once again, Belgarath at last decided that it was time to take up his interrupted journey.
"I don't really have anything pressing," he admitted. "But I'd like to look in on Belden and the twins, and it might be a good time to tidy up my tower. I have sort of let that slide over the past few hundred years."
"If you would like, we could go along," Polgora offered. "After all, you did help with the cottage. Not enthusiastically, perhaps, but you did help. It only seems right that we help you with cleaning your tower."
"Thanks all the same, Paul," he declined firmly. "But your idea of cleaning tends to be a bit too drastic for my taste. Things that might be important later have a way of winding up on the dust heap when you clean. As long as there's a clear space somewhere in the center, the room is clean enough for me."
"Oh, Father," she said, laughing, "you never change."
"Of course not," he replied.
He looked thoughtfully over at Erend, who was quietly eating his breakfast.
"If it is all right, though, I'll take the boy with me."
She gave him a quick look.
Belgarath shrugged. "He's company. He might enjoy a change of scenery. Besides, you and Durnick have not really had a chance to be alone since your wedding day. Call it a belated present, if you want."
She looked at him.
Thank you, Father, she said simply, and her eyes were suddenly very warm and filled with affection.
Belgorath looked away, almost as if her look embarrassed him. Did you want your things? From the tower, I mean. You've left quite a few trunks and boxes there at one time or another over the years.
Why, that's very nice of you, Father.
I need the space they're taking up, he said, then grinned at her.
You will watch the boy, won't you? I know your mind sometimes wanders when you start puttering around in your tower.
It'll be fine with me, Paul, the old man assured her. And so the following morning, Belgorath mounted his horse, and Durnick boosted Arond up behind him. I'll bring him home in a few weeks, Belgorath said, or at least by midsummer.
He leaned down, shook Durnick's hand, and then turned his mount toward the south. The air was still cool, although the early spring sunshine was very bright. The scents of stirring growth were in the air, and Arond, riding easily behind Belgorath, could feel Aldor's presence as they pressed deeper into the vale. He felt it as a calm and gentle kind of awareness, and it was dominated by an overpowering desire to know. The presence of the god Aldur here in the vale was not some vague spiritual permeation, but rather was quite sharp, on the very edge of being palpable. They moved on down into the vale, riding at an easy pace through the tall winter-browned grass. Broad trees dotted the open expanse, lifting their crowns to the sky, holding the tips of their branches, swollen with the urgency of budding leaves, up to receive the gentle kiss of sun-warmed air.
"Well, boy," Belgorath said after they had ridden a league or more.
"Where are the towers?"
Arond asked politely. "A bit farther. How did you know about the towers?"
"You and Polgara spoke of them."
"Eavesdropping is a very bad habit, Arond."
"Was it a private conversation?"
"No, I suppose not."
"Then it wasn't eavesdropping, was it?"
Belgorath turned sharply, looking over his shoulder at the boy riding behind him. "That's a pretty fine distinction for someone as young as you are. How did you arrive at it?"
Arond shrugged. "It just came to me. Do they always graze here like that?" He pointed at a dozen or so reddish-brown deer feeding calmly nearby.
"They have done so ever since I can remember. There is something about Aldur's presence that keeps animals from molesting each other."
They passed a pair of graceful towers linked by a peculiar, almost airy bridge arching between them, and Belgorath told him that they belonged to Beltira and Belkira, the twin sorcerers whose minds were so closely linked that they inevitably completed each other's sentences. A short while later they rode by a tower so delicately constructed of rose quartz that it seemed to almost float like a pink jewel in the lambent air. This tower, Belgorath told him, belonged to the hunchbacked Beldon, who had surrounded his own ugliness with a beauty so exquisite that it snatched one's breath away. At last they reached Belgorath's own squat, functional tower and dismounted.
"Well," the old man said, "here we are. Let's go up."
The room at the top of the tower was large, round, and incredibly cluttered. As he looked around it, Belgorath's eyes took on a defeated look.
"Oh, this is going to take weeks."
A great many things in the room attracted Arond's eye, but he knew that, in Belgorath's present mood, the old man would not be inclined to show him or to explain much of anything. He located the fireplace, found a tarnished brass scoop, and a short-handled broom, and knelt in front of the cavernous, soot-darkened opening.
"What are you doing?" Belgorath asked.
"Durnick says that the first thing you should do in a new place is to get a spot ready for your fire."
"Oh, he does he?"
"It's not usually a very big chore, but it gets you started, and once you get started, the rest of the job doesn't look so big. Durnick's very wise about things like that. Do you have a pail or a dustbin of some kind?"
"You're going to insist on cleaning the fireplace?"
"Well, if if you don't mind too much. It is pretty dirty, don't you think?
Belgrath sighed. Paul and Dernick have corrupted you already, boy. I tried to save you, but a bad influence like that always wins out in the end.
I suppose you're right,
Erend agreed.
Where did you say that pail was?
By evening, they had cleared a semi-circular area around the fireplace, finding in the process a couple of couches, several chairs, and a sturdy table.
I don't suppose you have anything to eat stored any place?
His stomach had told Erend that it was definitely moving on toward supper time. Belgarath looked up from a parchment scroll he had just fished out from under one of the couches.
What? Oh, yes. I'd almost forgotten. We'll go visit the twins. They are bound to have something on the fire.
Do they know we're coming?
Belgarath shrugged.
Oh, that doesn't really matter, Erend. You must learn that's what friends and family are for, to be imposed upon, one of the cardinal rules. If you want to get through life without overexerting yourself, when all else fails, fall back on friends and relations.
The twin sorcerers, Beltira and Belkira, were overjoyed to see them, and the something on the fire turned out to be a savory stew that was at least as good as the one that might have emerged from Polgara's kitchen. When Erend commented on that, Belgarath looked amused.
"Who do you think taught her how to cook?"
he asked. It was not until several days later when the cleaning of Belgarath's tower had progressed to the point where the floor was receiving its first scrubbing in a dozen or more centuries that Belden finally stopped by.
"What are you doing, Belgarath?"
the filthy, misshapen hinchback demanded. Belden was very short, dressed in battered rags, and he was gnarled like an old oak stump. His hair and beard were matted, and twigs and bits of straw clung to him in various places.
"Oh, just a little cleaning," Belgarath replied, looking almost embarrassed.
"What for? It's just going to get dirty again."
Belden looked at a number of very old bones lying along the curved wall.
"What you really ought to do is render down your floor for soup stock."
"Did you come by just to be disagreeable?"
"I saw the smoke from your chimney. I wanted to see if anybody was here or if all this litter had just taken fire spontaneously."
Erend knew that Belgarath and Belden were genuinely fond of each other, and that this banter between them was one of their favorite forms of entertainment. He continued with the work he was doing even as he listened.
"Would you like some ale?"
"Not if you brewed it," Belden replied ungraciously. "You would think that a man who drinks as much as you do would have learned how to make a decent ale by now."
"Well, that last batch wasn't so bad."
"I have run across stump water that tasted better."
"Quit worrying. I borrowed this keg from the twins."
"Did they know you were borrowing it?"
"What difference does that make? We all share everything anyway."
One of Belden's shaggy eyebrows raised.
"They share their food and drink, and you share your appetite and thirst. I suppose it works out."
"Well, of course it does."
Belgarath turned with a slightly pained look.
"Erend, do you have to do that?"
Erend looked up from the flagstones he was industriously scrubbing.
"Does it bother you?"
"Well, of course it bothers me. Don't you know it's terribly impolite to keep working like that when I'm resting?"
"I'll try to remember that. How long do you expect that you'll be resting?"
"Just put the brush down, Erend. That patch of floor has been dirty for a dozen centuries at least. Another day or so is not going to matter all that much."
"He's a great deal like Belgarian, isn't he?"
Belden said, sprawling in one of the chairs near the fire.
"Oh, it probably has something to do with Polgara's influence,"
Belgarath agreed, drawing two tankards of ale from the keg.
"She leaves marks on every boy she meets. I try to moderate the effects of her prejudices as much as possible, though."
He looked gravely at Erend.
I think this one is smarter than Geryon was. But he doesn't seem to have Geryon's sense of adventure, and he's just a bit too well-behaved. Oh, I'm sure you'll be able to work on that.
Belgareth settled himself into another chair and pushed his feet out toward the fire.
What have you been up to?
He asked the hunchback.
I haven't seen you since Geryon's wedding.
I thought that somebody ought to keep an eye on the Angorax,
Belden replied, scratching vigorously at one armpit.
And?
And what?
You know, that's an irritating habit you've picked up somewhere. What are the Angorax doing?
Oh, the Murgos are still all in little pieces about the death of Tauragas,
Belden laughed then.
He was completely mad, but he kept them unified, until Kohag ran his saber through him. His son Urgot isn't much of a king. He's barely able to get their attention. The Western Grolems can't even function anymore. Kushik's dead. Torak's dead. And about all the Grolems can do now is stare at the walls and count their fingers. My guess is that Murgo society is right on the verge of collapsing entirely.
Good. Getting rid of the Murgos has been one of my main goals in life.
I wouldn't start gloating just yet, Belden said sourly. After word reached Zakath that Belgarion had killed Torak, he threw off all pretenses about the fiction of Angorak unity and marched his Malorians on Rakgoska. Didn't leave much of it standing.
Belgareth shrugged. 'Twasn't a very attractive city anyway.
Oh, it's a lot less attractive now. Zakath seems to think that crucifixions and impalings are educational. He decorated what was left of the walls of Rakgoska with object lessons. Every time he goes any place in Tol Nurgos, he leaves a trail of occupied crosses and stakes behind him.
I find that I can bear the misfortunes of the Murgos with great fortitude,
Belgareth replied piously.
I think you had better take a more realistic look at things, Belgareth,
the hunchback growled at him.
We could probably match Murgo numbers if we really had to, but people don't talk about the uncountable hordes of boundless Meloria for nothing. Zakath has a very big army, and he commands most of the seaports on the east coast, so he can ship in as many more troops as he wants. If he succeeds in obliterating the Murgos, he's going to be camped on our southern doorstep with a lot of bored soldiers on his hands. Certain ideas are bound to occur to him at about that time.
Belgareth grunted. I'll worry about that when the time comes.
Oh, by the way, Belden said suddenly, with an ironic grin, I found out what that apostrophe is doing in his name.
Whose name?
Zakath's. Would you believe that it indicates the word cow?
Kal Zakath?
Belgareth stared at him incredulously.
Isn't that outrageous? I guess that the Malorian emperors have been secretly yearning to take that title since just after the Battle of Omimbri. But they were always afraid that Torak might wake up and take offense at their presumption. Now that he's dead, a fair number of Malorians have begun to call their ruler Kal Zakath. The ones who want to keep their heads do, at any rate.
What does Kal mean?
It is an Angorak word that means king and god, Belgareth explained. 500 years ago, Torak set aside the Malorian Emperor and personally led his hordes against the West. The Angoraks, all of them, Murgos, Nadraks, Tulls, as well as the Malorians, called him Kal Torak.
What happened?
Erend asked curiously.
When Kal Torak invaded the West, I mean.
Belgareth shrugged. It's a very old story.
Not until you've heard it,
Erend told him.
Belden gave Belgareth a sharp look. He is quick, isn't he?
Belgareth looked at Erend thoughtfully.
All right. Putting it very briefly, Kaltorak smashed Drasnia, laid siege to the Algerian stronghold for 8 years, and then crossed Ogoland to the plains of Arindia. The kingdoms of the west met him at Vomimbre, and he was struck down in a duel with the Raven Warder.
But not killed?
No, not killed. The Raven Warder struck him straight through the head with his sword, but Torak was not killed. He was only bound in slumber, until a king sat once again on the throne of Reva.
Belgarian.
Right. You know what happened then. You were there, after all.
Erend sighed.
Yes.
Belgarath turned back to Belden.
All right. What's going on in Meloria? Things are about the same as always,
Belden replied, taking a drink of ale and belching thunderously.
The bureaucracy is still the glue that holds everything together. There are still plots and intrigues in Melsin and Meldzeth. Coranda and Ashiva and Gandahar are on the very verge of open rebellion, and the Grolems are still afraid to go near Kel.
The Melorian Grolems are still a functioning church, then?
Belgarath seemed a little surprised.
I thought that the citizenry might have taken steps the way they did in Mishrakech Tull. I understand that the Tulls started building bonfires with Grolems.
Kalza Kath sent a few orders back to Melzeth, Belden told him, and the army stepped in to stop the slaughter. After all, you plan to be king and god. You're going to need yourself a church. Zakath seems to think that it might be easier to use one that's already established.
And what does Urvan think of that idea?
He's not making much of an issue of it right now. Before the army moved in, the people of Meloria were finding a great deal of entertainment in hanging Grolems up on iron hooks. Urvan is staying in Malyaska and keeping very quiet. I think he believes that the fact that he's still alive might just be an oversight on the part of his exalted majesty, Kalzakath. Urvan's a slimy snake, but he's no fool.
I have never met him.
You haven't missed a thing.
Belden held out his tankard.
You want to fill this?
You are drinking up all of my ale, Belden.
Oh, you can always steal more. The twins never lock their doors. Anyway, Urvan was a disciple of Torak, the same as Kluchik and Zadar. He doesn't have any of their good qualities, however.
They didn't have any good qualities, Belgarath said,
handing him back the refilled tankard.
Oh, compared to Urvan, they did. He's a natural-born bootlicker, a fawning, contemptible sneak. Even Torak despised him. But like all people with those charming traits, as soon as he got the least little bit of power, he went absolutely berserk with it. He's not satisfied with bows as a sign of respect. He wants people to grovel before him.
You seem moderately unfond of him.
I loathe that piebald backstabber.
Piebald?
He's got patches of skin on his face and hands with no color at all. He looks all splotchy, as if he had some gruesome disease. Well, I'm viewed in some quarters as passing ugly, but Urvan could scare a troll into fits. Anyway, if Kalzakath wants to turn the Grolem Church into a state religion with his face on the altars instead of Torax, he's going to have to deal with Urvan first. And Urvan always stays holed up in Malyaska, completely surrounded by Grolem sorcerers. Zakath won't be able to get near him. I can't even get near him. Oh, I give it a try every 100 years or so, hoping that somebody might get careless, or that I might get lucky enough to get a large, sharp hook into his guts. What I'd really like to do, though, is drag him face down over red-hot coals for a few weeks.
Belgarath looked a little surprised at the little man's vehemence.
That's all he's doing, then? Staying undercover in Malyaska?
Oh, not hardly. Urvan plots and schemes even in his sleep. In the last year and a half, ever since Belgarian ran a sword through Torak, Irvan's been scrambling around trying to preserve what's left of his church. There are some old moth-eaten prophecies. The Grolems call them oracles. From a place called Ashabah in the Kerandese Mountains. Irvan dusted them off, and he's been twisting them around so that they seem to say that Torak will return, that he's not dead, or that he'll be resurrected or possibly reborn. Belgarath snorted. What nonsense. Of course it is, but he had to do something. The Grolem Church was convulsing like a headless snake, and Zakath was right on the verge of putting his fist around everybody's throat to make sure that every time any Angorak bowed, it would be to him. Irvan made sure that there were very few copies of these Ashabeen oracles left lying about, and he's been inventing all sorts of things and claiming that he found them in the prophecies. That's about the only thing holding Zakath off right now. Probably that wouldn't even work if the Emperor weren't so busy trying to decorate every tree he comes across with a Murgo or two.
Did you have any trouble moving around in Meloria?
Belden snorted a crude obscenity. Of course not. Nobody even notices the face of a deformed man. Most people couldn't tell you if I'm Aelorn or Morag. They can't see past the hump on my back.
He rose from his chair, went to the cask, and refilled his tankard again.
Belgarath, he said very seriously, does the name Thrag Sardius mean anything to you?
Sardius? Sardonyx, you mean?
Belden shrugged.
The Malorian Grolems call it Thrag Sardius. What's the difference?
Sardonyx is a gemstone, sort of orange-colored, with milky white stripes. Not really very rare, or very attractive.
It doesn't quite match up with the way I heard the Malorians talk about it. From the way they used the name Thrag Sardius, I gather that it's a single stone and that it's got a certain kind of importance.
What sort of importance?
Oh, I can't say for sure. About all I could gather was that just about every Grolem in Meloria would trade his soul for the chance to get his hands on it.
Could just be some kind of internal symbol. Something to do with the power struggle that's going on over there.
That's possible, I suppose. But why would its name be Thrag Sardius, then? He called the Orb of Aldur Thrag Yaska, remember? There'd almost have to be a connection between Thrag Sardius and Thrag Yaska, wouldn't there? And if there is, maybe we ought to have a look into it.
Belgarath gave him a long look and then sighed.
I thought once Torak was dead, we might get a chance to rest.
You've had a year or so. Much more than that, and you start to get flabby.
You are a very disagreeable fellow, do you know that?
Belden gave him a tight, ugly grin.
Yes, I thought you might have noticed that.
The next morning, Belgarath began meticulously sorting through a mountainous heap of crackling parchments, trying to impose some kind of order upon centuries of chaos. Arend watched the old man quietly for a time, then drifted over to the window to look out at the sun-warmed meadows of the Vale. Perhaps a mile away, there was another tower, a tall, slender structure that looked somehow very serene.
"Do you mind if I go outside?"
"What? Oh, no, it's all right. Just don't wander too far away."
"I won't,"
Arend promised, going to the top of the stairway that spiraled down into the cool dimness below. The early morning sunlight slanted across the dew-drenched meadow, and skylarks sang and spun through the sweet-smelling air. A brown rabbit hopped out of the tall grass and regarded Arend quite calmly. Then it sat on its haunches and began vigorously to scratch its long ears with a busy hind foot. Arend had not come out of the tower for random play, however, nor to watch rabbits. He had some place to go, and he set out across the dewy green meadow in the direction of the tower he had seen from Belgarath's window. He had not really counted on the dew, and his feet were uncomfortably wet by the time he reached the solitary tower. He walked around the base of the stone structure several times, his feet squelching in their sodden boots.
"I wondered how long it would take you before you came by,"
a very calm voice said to him.
"I was busy helping Belgorath,"
Erend apologized.
"Did he really need the help?"
"He was having a little trouble getting started."
"Would you like to come up?"
"If it's all right."
"The door is on the far side."
Erend went around the tower and found a large stone that had been turned to reveal a doorway. He went into the tower and on up the stairs. One tower room was much like another, but there were certain differences between this one and Belgorath's. As in Belgorath's tower, there was a fireplace here with a fire burning in it, but there appeared to be nothing in the flames here for them to feed upon. The room itself was strangely uncluttered, for the owner of this tower stored his parchment scrolls, tools, and implements in some unimaginable place, to be summoned as he required them. The owner of the tower sat beside the fire. His hair and beard were white, and he wore a blue, loose-fitting robe.
"Come over to the fire and dry your feet, boy."
"Thank you."
"How is Pogora?"
"Oh, very well, and happy. She likes being married, I think."
He lifted one foot and held it close to the fire.
"Don't burn your shoes."
"I'll be careful."
"Would you like some breakfast?"
"Oh, that would be nice. Belgorath forgets about things like that sometimes."
"On the table there."
Erend looked at the table and saw a steaming bowl of porridge that had not been there before.
"Thank you,"
he said politely, going to the table and pulling up a chair.
"Was there something special you wanted to talk about?"
"Oh, not really,"
Erend replied, picking up a spoon and starting on the porridge.
"I just thought I should come by. The veil is yours, after all."
"Pulver has been teaching you manners, I see."
Erend smiled.
And other things, too."
"Are you happy with her, Erend?"
"Yes, Alder, I really am,"
Erend replied and continued to eat his porridge. Chapter 3 As the summer progressed, Erend found himself rather naturally more and more in the company of Durnick. The smith, he soon discovered, was an extraordinarily patient man who did things the old way. Not so much because of some moral bias against what Belgorath called the alternative we have available to us, but rather because he took a deep satisfaction in working with his hands. This was not to say that Durnick did not occasionally take shortcuts. Erend noticed a certain pattern to the smith's evasions. Durnick absolutely would not cheat on any project involving making something for Pulgara or for their home. No matter how laborious or tedious those projects might be, Durnick completed them with his hands and his muscles. Certain outside activities, however, were not quite so closely tied up with Durnick's sense of ethics. 200 yards of rail fence, for example, appeared rather quickly one morning. The fence needed to be there. There was no question of that, since a nearby herd of Alger cattle had to be diverted from plodding with bovine stubbornness across Pulgara's garden on their way to water. As a matter of fact, the fence actually began to appear instantly just in front of the startled cows. They regarded the first 50 feet or so in bafflement. Then, after considering the problem for several minutes, they moved to go around the obstruction. Another 50 feet of fence appeared in their path. In time, the cows grew surly about the whole thing, and even tried running, perhaps thinking in their sluggish way that they might be able to outrace this phantom fence-builder. Durnick, however, sat planted on a stump, his eyes intent, and his face determined, extending his fence section by section in front of the increasingly irritable cows. One dark brown bull, finally goaded into a fury of frustration, lowered his head, pawed the earth a few times, and charged the fence with a great bellow. Durnick made a peculiar twisting gesture with one hand, and the bull was suddenly charging away from the fence, turned around somehow in mid-stride without even knowing it. He ran for several hundred yards before it occurred to him that his horns had not yet encountered anything substantial. He slowed and raised his head in astonishment. He looked dubiously back over his shoulder at the fence, then turned around and gave it another try. Once again Durnick turned him, and once again he charged ferociously off in the wrong direction. The third time he tried it, he charged over the top of the hill and disappeared on the other side. He did not come back. Durnick looked gravely at Erend, then he winked. Polgara came out of the cottage drying her hands on her apron and noted the fence which had somehow constructed itself while she had been washing the breakfast dishes. She gave her husband a quizzical look, and Durnick seemed a bit abashed at having been caught using sorcery rather than an axe.
"Very nice fence, dear," she said encouragingly to him.
"We kind of needed one there," he said apologetically. "Those cows, well, I had to do it in a hurry."
"Durnick, there is nothing morally reprehensible about using your talent for this sort of thing, and you should practice every so often."
She looked at the zigzag pattern of the interlocking rail fence, and then her expression became concentrated. One after another, each of the junctures of the rails was suddenly bound tightly together with stout rose bushes in full bloom.
"There," she said contentedly, patting her husband's shoulder, then went back inside.
"She's a remarkable woman. Do you know that?" Durnick said to Erend.
"Yes,"
Erend agreed. Polgara was not always pleased with her husband's venture into this new field, however. On one occasion, toward the hot, dusty end of summer, when the vegetables in her garden were beginning to wilt, Polgara devoted the bulk of one morning to locating a small black rain cloud over the mountains in Ulgoland and gently herding its sodden puffiness toward the Vale of Aldur, more specifically, toward her thirsty garden. Erend was playing along the fence when the cloud came in low over the hill to the west, then stopped directly over the cottage and the waiting garden. Durnick glanced up from the harness he was mending, saw the blonde-haired boy at play and the ominous black cloud directly over his head, and rather negligently pulled in his will. He made a small flipping gesture with one hand.
"Shoo," he said to the cloud.
The cloud gave a peculiar sort of twitch, almost like a hiccup, then slowly flowed on eastward. When it was several hundred yards beyond Polgara's parched garden, it began to rain, a nice, steady, soaking downpour that very satisfactorily watered several acres of empty grassland. Durnick was not at all prepared for his wife's reaction. The door to the cottage banged open, and Polgara emerged with her eyes flashing. She gave the happily raining cloud a hard stare, and the soggy-looking thing gave another of those peculiar hiccups and actually managed to look guilty. Then Polgara turned and looked directly at her husband, her eyes a bit wild.
"Did you do that?"
she demanded, pointing at the cloud.
"Why, yes," he replied. "I suppose I did, Paul."
"Why did you do that?"
"Well, Erend was out there playing,"
Durnick said, still concentrating most of his attention on the harness.
"I didn't think you'd want him to get wet."
Polgara looked at the cloud, wasting all of its rain on grass so deeply rooted that it could have easily survived a 10-month drought. Then she looked at her garden and its drooping turnip tops and pathetic beans. She clenched her teeth tightly together to keep in certain words and phrases which she knew might shock her straight-laced and proper husband. She raised her face to the sky and lifted her arms in supplication.
"Why me?" she demanded in a loud, tragic voice. "Why me?"
"Why, dear?" Durnick said mildly. "Whatever's wrong?"
Polgara told him what was wrong, at some length. Durnick spent the next week putting in an irrigation system leading from the upper end of their valley to Polgara's garden, and she forgave him for his mistake almost as soon as he had finished it. The winter came late that year, and autumn lingered in the vale. The twins, Beltira and Belkira, came by just before the snows set in and told them that after several weeks of discussion, both Belgrath and Belden had left the Vale, and that each of them had gone away with that serious expression on his face that meant there was trouble somewhere. Erend missed Belgarath's company that winter. To be sure, the old sorcerer had more often than not managed to get him in trouble with Polgara, but Erend felt somehow that he should not really be expected to devote every waking moment to staying out of trouble. When the snow came, he took up sledding again. After she had watched him come flying down the hill and across the meadow a few times, Polgara prudently asked Durnick to erect a barrier at the stream bank to prevent a recurrence of the previous winter's mishap. It was while the smith was erecting a woven wattle fence to keep Erend on dry land that he happened to glance down into the water. Because the often muddy little rills that emptied into their stream were all locked in ice now, the water was low and as clear as crystal. Durnick could very clearly see the long, narrow shapes hovering like shadows in the current above the beds of gravel that formed the bottom. "What a curious thing," he murmured, his eyes taking on that peculiarly abstracted look. "I've never noticed them there before."
"I've seen them jumping," Erend said. "But most of the time the water's too cloudy to see them when they're lying underwater."
"I imagine that's the reason for it, all right," Durnick agreed.
He tied the end of the wattle fence to a tree and thoughtfully walked through the snow toward the shed he had built at the back of the cottage. A moment or so later he emerged with the skein of waxed cord in his hand. 5 minutes later he was fishing. Erend smiled and turned to trudge back up the long hill, towing his sled behind him. When he reached the top of the hill, a strange, hooded young woman waited him.
"Can I help you?"
The young woman pushed back her hood to reveal the fact that a dark cloth was tightly bound across her eyes.
"Thou art the one they call Erend?" she asked.
Her voice was low and musical, and there was a peculiar lilt to her archaic speech.
"Yes, I am. Did you hurt your eyes?" "Nay, gentle child, I must needs look upon the world by a light other than that of the mundane sun. Would you like to come down to our cottage? You could warm yourself by our fire, and Polgara would welcome company." "Though I revere the Lady Polgara, the time has not yet arrived for us to meet,"
the young woman said.
"And it is not cold where I am."
She paused and bent forward slightly, as if she were in fact peering at him, though the cloth over her eyes was quite thick.
"It is true, then," she murmured softly. "We could not be certain at such great distance. But now that I am face to face with thee, I know that there can be no mistake."
She straightened then.
"We will meet again, as you wish, ma'am,"
Erend replied, remembering his manners. She smiled, and her smile was so radiant that it seemed almost to bring sunlight to the murky winter afternoon.
"I am Xeradas," she said, "and I bear thee friendship, gentle Erend, even though the time may come when I must needs decide against thee."
And then she vanished, disappearing so suddenly that she was there and then gone, in the space of a single heartbeat. Startled a bit, Erend glanced at the snow where she had stood and saw that there were no marks or footprints. He sat down on his sled to think about it. Nothing that the strange young woman had said really seemed to make much sense, but he was fairly sure that a time would come when it would. After a bit of thought, he concluded that this peculiar visit would upset Polgara if she heard about it. Since he was certain that this Xeradas posed no threat and meant him no harm, he decided that he would not mention the incident. Then, because it was growing quite chilly atop the hill, he pushed his sled into motion and coasted down the long slope and across the meadow to within a few dozen yards of where Durnick was fishing with such total concentration that he was oblivious of all that was going on around him. Polgara was tolerant about Durnick's pastime, She was always suitably impressed at the length, weight, and silvery color of the prizes he brought home, and she drew upon all her vast knowledge to find new and interesting ways to fry, bake, broil, roast, and even poach fish. She adamantly insisted, however, that he clean them. When spring returned once again, Belgarath came by, mounted on a spirited roan stallion.
"What happened to your mare?" Durnick asked the old man as he dismounted in the dooryard of the cottage.
Belgarath made a sour face. "I was halfway to Drasnia when I discovered that she was pregnant. I traded her for this enthusiast."
He gave the prancing roan a hard look.
"It looks as if you might have gotten the best of the bargain," Durnick mused, looking Belgarath's horse over. "The mare was sedate and sensible," the old man disagreed. "This one does not have a brain in his head. All he wants to do is show off, running, jumping, rearing, and pawing in the air with his hooves."
He shook his head in disgust. "Put him in the barn, father," Belgarath suggested, "and wash up. You are just in time for supper. You can have a baked fish. As a matter of fact, you can have several baked fish if you'd like." After they had eaten, Belgarath turned his chair around, leaned back, and pushed his feet out toward the fire. He looked around with a contented smile at the polished flagstone floor, the limed white walls with polished pots and kettles hanging on pegs, and at the dancing light and shadow coming from the arched fireplace.
"Oh, it's good to relax a bit. I don't think I've stopped moving since I left here last autumn."
"What is it that's so pressing, father?"
"Belden and I had quite a long talk," the old man replied. "There are some things going on in Meloria that I don't quite like."
"What earthly difference can it make now, father? Our interest in Meloria ended at Thul Mishrak when Torak died. You were not appointed caretaker of the world, you know."
"Oh, I wish it were that easy, Paul. Does the name the Sardian mean anything to you? Or Thragsadius, perhaps?"
She was pouring hot water from a kettle into the large pan in which she customarily washed dishes, but she stopped, frowning slightly.
"I think I heard a Grolem say something about Thragsadius once. He was delirious and babbling in Old Angrak."
"Can you remember what he was saying?"
"I'm sorry, father, but I don't speak Old Angrak. You never got around to teaching me, remember?"
She looked at Erend and crooked one finger at him. Erend sighed disconsolately, got up and fetched a dish towel. "Don't make faces, Erend. It does not hurt you to help clean up after supper." She looked back at Belgarath as she started to wash the dishes. "What is the significance of the Sardian, or whatever you call it?"
"I don't know," Belgarath replied, scratching at his beard in perplexity. "As Belden pointed out, though, Torek called our master's orb Thragyaska. It is possible, I suppose, that Thragsardius might be connected in some way."
"I picked up a lot of possibles and supposes and mights in there, father. I wonder if you are not chasing after shadows out of habit, or just to keep busy?"
"You know me well enough to know that I am not all that enthusiastic about keeping busy, Paul."
"Oh, so I've noticed. Is anything else happening in the world?"
"Oh, let's see." Belgarath leaned back and stared speculatively at the low-beamed ceiling. "The Grand Duke Neragon ate something that definitely did not agree with him."
"Who is the Grand Duke Neragon, and why are we interested in his digestion?"
"The Grand Duke Neragon was the candidate of the Honth family to succeed Ranbarun on the imperial throne of Tornedra," Belgarath smirked. "He was a complete and total jackass, and his ascension to the throne would have been an unmitigated disaster." "You said was," Durnick noted. "Right. Neragon's indigestion proved fatal. It is widely suspected that some splendid Horbite sympathizer used a certain exotic condiment that came from the jungles of Nyssa to season the Grand Duke's last lunch. The, symptoms, I understand, were quite spectacular. The Honoths are in total disarray, and the other families are gloating outrageously.
Tolnedrin politics are disgusting.
Our Prince Keldar appears to be well on his way toward becoming the wealthiest man in the world, Belgarath continued. Silk?
Durnick looked a bit amazed.
Has he managed to steal that much already? I gather that what he's doing is sort of legitimate this time. He and that rascal Yarblek have somehow managed to gain control of the entire Nadrak fur harvest. I was not able to get all of the details, but the screams of anguish coming from the major commercial houses in Boktor would seem to indicate that our friends are doing rather well.
I'm pleased to hear that, Durnick said.
That's probably because you have not been in the market for a fur cape lately, Belgarath chuckled. The price has taken quite a jump, I understand.
The old man rocked back in his chair.
In Chthalmurgos, your friend Kalzakath is methodically butchering his way down the east coast. He has added Rakhtan and Rakhaga to the list of cities he has captured and depopulated. I'm not too fond of Murgos, but it is just possible that Zakath is going a little too far.
Kalzakath?
Polgara asked with one eyebrow slightly raised.
An affectation, Belgarath shrugged.
More likely a symptom, she observed. Angarak rulers always seem to be unstable in one way or another. She turned to look at her father. Well?
Well, what?
Have you heard anything from Reva? How are Geryon and Tenedra doing?
I have not heard a sound. Oh, a few official things. The Riven King is pleased to announce the appointment of Earl What's-His-Name as Riven Ambassador to the Kingdom of Drasnia. You know, that sort of thing. But nothing in the least bit personal.
We are sure he knows how to write, are we not? She demanded exasperatedly. I am sure that he's not so busy that he has not had the time to write at least one letter in the last 2 years. He did,
Aaron said quietly.
He might not have mentioned the letter, but it seemed to be very important to Polgara. She looked at him sharply. What did you say? Belgarion wrote to you last winter, Aaron said. The letter got lost, though, when the ship his messenger was aboard sank. If the ship sank, then how do you...
Paul, Belgarath said in a tone that seemed uncharacteristically firm. Why don't you let me handle this?
He turned to Erend.
You say that Geryon wrote a letter to Polgra last winter?
Yes.
But that the letter was lost when the messenger's ship sank?
Erend nodded.
Why did he not write another one, then?
He doesn't know that the ship sank.
But you do. Erend nodded again. Do you, by any chance, know what the letter said?
Yes.
Do you suppose you could recite it for us?
I guess I could if you want. Belgarion's going to write another one in a week or so, though.
Belgarath gave him a strange look. Why don't you tell us what the first one said? That way we won't miss anything.
All right,
Erend agreed.
He frowned, concentrating very hard.
He started out by saying, Dear Aunt Paul and Durnick, I think that's sort of nice, don't you?
Just recite the letter, Erend, Belgarath said patiently. Save the comments for later.
All right.
Erend stared thoughtfully into the fire.
I'm sorry I haven't written earlier, he recited. But I've been terribly busy learning how to be a good king. It's easy enough to be king. All you need is to be born into the right family. To be a good king is harder, though. Brand helps me as much as he can, but I still have to make a lot of decisions about things that I don't really understand. Tsinedra is well. At least I think so. we are hardly talking to each other anymore, so it's kind of hard to say for sure. Brand is a bit concerned that we haven't had any children yet, but I don't think he needs to worry. So far as I can tell, we're never going to have any children, and maybe it's just as well. I really think we should have gotten to know each other a little better before we got married. I'm sure that there's some way that we could have called it off. Now it's too late. We'll just have to make the best of it. If we don't see each other too much, we can usually manage to be civil to each other, at least civil enough to keep up appearances. Barak came by in that big warboat of his last summer, and we had a very good visit. He told me all about...
Just a moment, Erend. Polgara stopped the recitation. Does he say any more about the trouble he is having with Saenedra?
No, ma'am,
Erend replied after a moment, during which he quickly ran through the rest of the letter in his mind.
He wrote about Barak's visit and some news he got from King Anheg, and a letter from Mandarallan. That's about all. He said that he loves you and misses you very much. That's how we ended it.
Polgara and Belgarath exchanged a very long look. Erend could feel their perplexity, but he was not sure exactly how to set their minds at rest about the matter.
You are sure that's the way the letter went? Belgarath asked him.
Erend nodded.
That's what he wrote.
And you knew what was in the letter as soon as he wrote it?
Erend hesitated.
I don't know if it was like that exactly. It doesn't really work that way, you know. You have to sort of think about it. And I didn't really think about it until the subject came up, when Polgara was talking about it just now.
Does it matter how far away the other person is?
Belgarath asked curiously.
No,
Erend replied.
I don't think so. It just seems to be there when I want it to be.
No one can do that, father, Polgara said to the old man. No one has ever been able to do that.
Apparently, the rules have changed, Belgarath said thoughtfully. I think we will have to accept it as genuine, don't you?
She nodded.
He doesn't have any reason to make it up. I think you and I are going to have some very long talks together, Erend, the old man said.
Perhaps, Polgara said, but not just yet. She turned back to the boy. Could you repeat what Geryon said about Saenedra for me?
Erend nodded.
Saenedra is well, at least I think so. We are hardly talking to each other anymore, so it's kind of hard to say for sure. Brand is a bit concerned that...
That's fine, Erend, she said, raising one hand slightly. Then she looked into the boy's face. After a moment, one of her eyebrows shot up. Tell me, she said, very carefully choosing her words.
Do you know what is wrong between Geryon and Saenedra?
Yes,
Erend replied.
Saenedra did something that made Geryon very angry, and then he did something that embarrassed her in public, and that made her angry. She thinks that he doesn't pay enough attention to her, and that he spends all of his time on his work, so that he won't have to spend any with her. He thinks that she's selfish and spoiled, and doesn't think about anybody but herself. They're both wrong, but they've had a lot of arguments about it, and they've hurt each other so much with some of the things they've said that they've both given up on being married to each other. They're terribly unhappy.
Thank you, Erend, she said.
Then she turned to Durnik. We will need to pack a few things.
Oh, said Durnik, looking a bit surprised.
We are going to Riva, she said quite firmly.